From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Americans are worried about their jobs, about their health care, about the rising cost of just about everything, about what would become of them if something went wrong. Tonight on Point, working without a net, risk and the new American economic insecurity. But first in Washington, 40 Republican House members gathered yesterday to push for a slowdown in government spending, just one day after Bush's State of the Union speech, where he promised to shrink the deficit and cut wasteful spending. Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor, and I asked her why the increased pressure now.
I think the deficit numbers that started surfacing at the end of 2002 have become very alarming to conservatives who are up for re-election. Remember, this is a party that won its way back to power on the Hill on the strength of fiscal responsibility. And the idea of $500 billion deficit this year and for the next 10 is a very daunting number for conservatives.
And what are the particular sticking points? Is the Bush administration spending on steroids?
Now, that phrase has actually picked up a lot of currency lately. No, their assumption is that the tax cuts and the stimulus that the deficit is giving the economy right now is going to launch it into a new phase of sustained growth, and that without that stimulus, there's no way that the country is going to be able to pay for the retirement of the baby boomers in 10 years. So it's kind of a calculated gamble, but it's one that a range of economic research groups are no longer accepting. They've got people ranging from the Brookings Institute to Committee on Economic Development, a kind of business-based group, you know, from the left to the right to Cato Institute, libertarian groups, to the International Monetary Fund, all saying that this level of deficit sustained over a 10-year period is fiscal ruin.
And in fact, this seems to be resonating among voters as well. I'm looking at some figures here by the Pew Research Center, which said that 51% of respondents called the deficit a top priority now. That was up from 40% just a year ago and 35% 2 years ago.
That's right. There is beginning to be a reaction to this, but you know, if you follow the debate that's going on the Hill now on Social Security, it is still safer for politicians to do something in the short term, like lower your taxes, than to talk about what's coming in 10 or 15 years, which is two lifetimes in politics, so that the people who are saying now we need to do something about Social Security are taking a political risk that some would rather not take.
And again, here we are in an election year that is traditionally the time that all lawmakers in Congress want to be able to point toward the spending that they're able to bring to their districts. So do you see real signs of fiscal restraint happening here?
None. Witness the omnibus bill that just passed today in the Senate that included things like $2 million to promote golf awareness in Florida. I mean, to pass an item like that without blushing at a time when the deficit is $500 billion is staggering. But politics is local, and even the strongest deficit hawks like to report back to home about what they're able to deliver. Mm. So I think your point is very well taken.
So are these conservative Republicans feeling pretty frustrated at this point?
Well, they're all gathering for a caucus meeting this weekend. It'll be interesting to see. I think the closest parallel is the Medicare vote, where you had something like 60 or 70 conservatives saying, this is not the time to add a big new entitlement to Medicare when we know that the system is going to start going bankrupt, you know, when the baby boomers are into their retirement. It's not the time to add this. But when push came to shove, only 25 of them actually voted against it. So I think the numbers now, I think there was a letter signed by something like 90 conservative Republicans saying we shouldn't be growing the budget at all this year. It ought to be zero growth. We ought to have offsets for all the new spending we do. By the time that comes to those late-night, elbow-wrenching votes on the floor of the House, I think you may see it drop closer to 25 as well. But make no mistake, this is a real real bone-crunching issue for Republicans because it speaks to what was the principle on which most of them were elected, fiscal responsibility.
There does seem to be no small irony here in the fact that at the end of the Clinton administration, there was an enormous surplus, and now we are facing an enormous deficit.
By some estimates, it's a swing of $10 trillion, which is historic in its size and scope. Although, you know, those 10-year projections are very unreliable. Still, you have Democrats who are making very strong points on this. But, you know, Gail, we have to say that they've got a problem, too, because they're calling for more spending. So you have both parties on a deficit tilting binge for different reasons. It's going to be very hard to come together, as you say, especially in an election year.
Well, will those conservative Republicans be able to align with enough conservative Democrats to affect some kind of change, or is it just unrealistic for anything to happen this year?
I think it's going to be a much tougher budget battle than we've seen in the past. I think the president is going to have a very difficult time if his budget looks like what he signaled it would be in the State of the Union. I think eventually something will get through. Eventually, many of those Republicans will come round. But I think there is no question that whatever happens next year after the election is going to have to be a more serious retrenchment on the spending side. And this is what some Democrats fear was planned all along, that the deficits will be ballooned very large to grease much more substantial cuts down the line. That's been a kind of conspiracy theory on the left for some time. But the debate I'm hearing among conservatives is interesting, too, because people are saying behind the scenes, but quite openly, this may be the price to keep power, big government, that small government is really only a formula for an insurrection. It's not a formula for holding on to power. To hold on to power, you have to do things like pass a Medicare entitlement to keep seniors on board. And maybe it will take a turnover of power in the Congress, again, based on fiscal responsibility to change this pattern.
Well, Gail Chadwick, thanks so much for your insight.
Thank you.
Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. Once upon a time in America, a person worked for the same employer for a few decades, not just a few years. They built up a pension and retired. The vision of a great society unencumbered by financial anxieties was painted by FDR as a happy valley.
I see a United States which can demonstrate that under democratic methods of government, national wealth can be translated into a spreading volume of human comfort hitherto unknown, and the lowest standard of living can be raised far above the level of mere subsistence.
That was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his 1937 inaugural address. Well, now, more than two generations later, Americans find themselves living with ever greater economic risk. And over the past 30 years, that risk has been shifting steadily from government and corporations into the laps of America's working families. That good old pension is now your voluntary 401k. That steady job is more like treading water. More risk can mean more reward, but it also means more anxiety. Our guest tonight points out that as the risks that families live with grow, the safety net designed to catch them when things go wrong is actually shrinking. Tonight on Point, the new American economic insecurity. And listeners, we want to have you tell us your story. Have you been burned by a lack of a social safety net? Do you feel economically insecure? How do you define it? How does it affect your life? Is risk good in a society or bad? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Jacob Hacker. He is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Yale University and the author of The Divided Welfare State, The Battle Over Public and Private Social Benefits in the United States. Also, The Road to Nowhere, the genesis of President Clinton's plan for health security. And joining me from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. So let's get right into it, Jacob Hacker. What's the evidence that people are feeling more anxious and insecure? And if it's there, what's prompting it?
Well, the evidence is both personal and statistical. Certainly all of us know the stories. We read it in the news. We hear it from our friends. I should say that when I wrote the op-ed for the New York Times that sort of laid out this argument, I was frankly overwhelmed by the volume of response that I received. I had everything from Nobel laureates to average working people writing me to tell me their stories or to ask about my evidence. So the personal stories are the ones we've heard, but I'm afraid that we haven't always taken those stories and constructed a bigger picture. So what I've been doing in my work is trying to figure out how we can trace over time the degree to which families are facing economic risk. And what I've done is used a unique data set that has been constructed at the University of Michigan and actually traces the same set of families over the last 35 or so years. It's called the Panel Study of Income Dynamics. And using that data set, it's actually possible to look at how families' income varies over time. And when I got into this project, I have to say I didn't have any strong expectations about what I would see in the data. This data, as the Nobel laureate who wrote me said, is notoriously variable over time. It tends to fluctuate back and forth, much like a sort of random walk of the stock market. And so what I found was truly arresting. What I did is I decomposed the data into two parts. I looked at how much variance or difference there was across families, different families, and how much variance or difference there was over time within the same family's economic circumstances. And the first measure is just inequality, that is the difference across families. And of course, we know that that's gone up dramatically in the United States over the last 30 years.
So more haves, more have-nots, less in the middle? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, what we're finding in all of the evidence is that there's been an extreme concentration of income at the very top of the income scale. The Census Bureau data suggests that the top 20% or so of Americans have enjoyed most of the gains in income of the last two decades, and the top 1% have seen a dramatic increase. Their share of national income has risen roughly from 7 or 8% of total income to 13 to 14% of total income. But that's a familiar story. What I was interested in is how families' income varied over time, and you're able to actually compare these two numbers. And the very striking thing was that there was a dramatic increase. At one point in the 90s, the number was nearly five times as great as it had been in the early 1970s. And that increase was a lot larger than the increase in inequality across families. So in other words, there's a lot of evidence that families' incomes are becoming a lot more unstable.
And Jack, I want to hear from you on this because this is certainly something you know a great deal about as well.
Luckily, I haven't had to suffer it. But yes, I've certainly been concerned about it. And I think this is a very important metric that Professor Hacker has developed here, the measurement of insecurity within families. We also know that over this same period of time, the movement, the social mobility of families, that is, moving up from over a generation, has slowed down. In fact, according to a study recently in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, we have less mobility now over generations and have had in these 30 years than the British with their class system. And so you've got income inequality, income volatility, a slowdown in upward mobility. And this very period from 72 on is the first period in American history when we have had unilateral free trade. Up until 1960, we added manufacturing jobs. John Kennedy was elected president. He set about to cut tariffs 50%. He did. And by the time the 70s came along, we were making an experiment that only one other nation had made, Britain, in the 19th century. And Britain went from being the world's dominant industrial power to being third, fourth, basically dependent on other countries 100 years later.
All right. Well, we're going to continue in just a moment. We're talking this hour about risk and the new American economic insecurity. And we ask, have you been burned by a lack of a social safety net? Do you feel economically insecure? And how do you define it? Is risk a good thing or a bad thing? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the new American economic insecurity, risk, living without a social safety net. So tell us your story. Have you been burned by lack of health care or a 401k? Do you feel more economically insecure than your parents did? And is risk a good thing or a bad thing? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we are talking with Jacob Hacker, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Yale University, and with On Point News Analyst Jack Beattie. So, Jacob, why haven't we noticed this before?
Well, as I said, I think in one sense, we all know this. It taps in, this finding taps into something that we all feel, but we have a difficult time putting a finger on. The fact that we feel as if the society has grown increasingly insecure economically, that risk has shifted from the kinds of intermediaries that once protected us, employers, government, insurance companies, onto families and individuals. But I think one of the reasons that we've really missed this full picture and focused mostly on the individual stories, besides the difficulties of carrying out this kind of analysis, is that we've really focused on the year-to-year or day-to-day trend, the degree to which the economy is up or down at any particular moment. And the way I like to think about this is that we focus mostly on the waves on the surface of the ocean rather than the tide. And the tide has been going out for 30 years now. The boats, of American families are at a lower point than they once were. Some years they're up and some years they're down, but I think the longer term trend is quite clear now that Americans are really facing these risks on their own in a way they haven't in the past. And that's had big consequences, I think, for how Americans feel and for the way in which our economy and society works.
Well, and is that at least in part because the social safety net was designed for the 1930s and, you know, life in 2004 is very different from what it was then?
That's certainly a large part of it. The social safety net in the United States is unlike that in any other nation in the sense that it really is almost a full partnership between government and the private sector. Employers provide many of the benefits that in other countries are provided directly by the government: health insurance, pensions, child care benefits, and so on. We're the only country, for example, that does not have near universal health insurance coverage provided via some kind of public means. And so what's happened over the last 2 to 3 decades, and really going back further, is that the American society has shifted in fundamental ways. The government programs have not. And at the same time, the private sector programs have, quite frankly, eroded significantly. The number of Americans who don't have insurance through their employer has dramatically increased. And the nature of pension plans has changed almost as dramatically. And it used to be you would get a so-called defined benefit pension from your employer. It told you how much you'd get every year in retirement. If you lived longer than expected, you'd still get the same benefit. Now, there were lots of problems with the system, but the new system, the 401k defined contribution system, puts a lot of risk and responsibility on the individual. And at some point, Americans have a difficult time managing these very significant risks.
Well, and even if you do everything right and you have a 401k, that can still be wiped out a la Enron.
Absolutely. And the Enron scandal really highlighted two things. One, it highlighted that for many Americans, risks don't happen all individually. You lose your job, you lose your pension, you may have family problems, you may have a new kid in the family, there may be illness. These things tend to come in tandem. And with Enron, it was understandable why they did, because when the company failed, the stock plummeted, and most of the Enron employees had a huge share of their pension in the company stock. There are very few regulations on defined contribution plans, such as were placed on defined benefit plans, and they're not insured as are defined benefit plans by the government. There's a pension benefit guarantee corporation that actually insures defined benefit plans. But at the moment, there are really so few defined benefit plans relative to defined contribution plans. Most people who are in these plans are enjoying them because they've been in the workforce for a number of years. Almost all the new plans that are being set up are defined contribution plans. It's a big shift on the part of government and on the part of corporations in their assumption. They're used to think that a big part of being being an employer and a big part of being a representative was constructing a kind of framework, a safety net that would help Americans. And the new assumption is that Americans really need to be encouraged to take personal responsibility, to go out there and make their own success and bear the risks. Sometimes the risks are too great for Americans to bear, and I think that's what this evidence suggests.
Jack, I want you to jump in here. How do you see this playing out as personal responsibility versus government and private responsibility?
Well, you know, it's a little bit like while you're up, do something about globalization. You know, at no point has American individualism, sort of as defined as sort of the archetype Herbert Hoover, whose basic idea was that life is a matter of is a game, a race. Risk is the nature of it. At no time has that been less appropriate to the circumstances in which we find ourselves, where we simply, as a nation, are not in control of the basic economic forces surging through our world. And yet, individualism as a creed is now everywhere. It is made a comeback precisely when it could not be less relevant to our world. And this ideological problem, this problem about not even being able to come up with a word to describe what's happening, is, I think, one of the threshold problems that preserves economic insecurity. Not only that, that makes it seem like a good thing in some miracle way. It's great. You get up there and you make your own way in the world and all the rest of this. Forgetting, of course, that throughout American history, the great advances have come through and turns in technology, government subsidy to railroads, government subsidy to the computer industry, interstate highway system, collective endeavors from start to finish. No, not in the new mythology. We get up and we say to globalization, you don't bother me today. I'm going to go out and make my own world.
Well, not surprisingly, there are a lot of listeners who want to get in on this conversation. We're going first to Providence, Rhode Island. We want to hear from Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome.
Thank you. I enjoy your show so much. Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to share the fact that my husband and I, you know, both are college and post-college graduates, and we have good positions. We do have health insurance, and we have three teenage children. And, you know, our reality is that we know we can't count on Social Security. We understand that we're responsible for our own retirement. And we also realize that that's probably not going to be what our parents have had, what we've seen our parents experience in their lives. We are not able to save to the extent that we have a real good safety net. I mean, we have kids coming up to college, and frankly, you know, I often think we're close to that line. If one of us lost our work and we're not able to make an income, we'd be in some big trouble and would have to probably turn to family for assistance.
So you feel pretty vulnerable. Are you angry about this?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have not felt angry about it. I have felt, frankly, responsible for myself. You know, as your guest said, we make our own reality and we work hard to create what we've been able to have and provide for our children, which has been pretty good so far. But, you know, right now as a consultant, I have been thinking that it might behoove me to get back into a position where I can have a solid monthly input into a 401k and also just have the stability of a regular income as opposed to the consulting work that I do now. We know for a fact that we would not separate ourselves, for instance, from my husband's position where he gets great health benefits, because where would we be then? Mm-hmm. We would really be in trouble. I think that for people in this country who are trying to, you know, secure themselves and families who are not in as good a position even as my husband and I are in, that it's very, very difficult. It causes high anxiety, and these are stressful times that we live in. And I think that, you know, it's just a reality. We don't expect to retire at 55 like my dad did, you know. Mm. it's going to be, we're going to be in our 70s, and hopefully we'll, you know, have fun while we work. And that's one thing that's also influenced how we parent, for instance, with our teenage children, to suggest that they really make sure they get into fields that they enjoy learning about and have curiosity about. So we're really thinking about lifetime sort of goals and realities for them as well as for ourselves.
Well, we hear you, Elizabeth, and thanks for sharing your story. I would imagine this is one you've heard before, Jacob.
I can't tell you how many times I've heard it. And what I think is really striking about Elizabeth's story is it encapsulates the sort of larger story about what's happening to the American economy. I mean, Elizabeth and her husband are relatively well off, it sounds like. Both are well educated, and they both work. But Elizabeth is working, as I understood it, as a contractor at the moment. She's clearly in a more uncertain position than she might be otherwise. They're relying on her husband's health insurance benefits. And I think that's really the two big changes. It's first, work has changed in important ways, in ways that we often find quite attractive. It's become freer, more mobile, but also there's greater reward for greater work. But that's created, at the same time, a lot of uncertainty and anxiety. And at the same time, women have really moved into the workforce over the last three decades. And that's meant that most families are relying on two incomes. They've had to. For middle-income families, that's really been the only way to stay afloat. But the outcome is that they're facing a lot more risk because either family member could run into problems. And what happens if their kids get sick, or what happens if either of them are disabled or come down with a serious illness? Suddenly they're going to be facing maybe half the income that they previously had. To live a middle-class life on that is really difficult.
And Jack, I want to pose the question to you of how you see this fitting into partisan politics, how Republicans and Democrats view the world, because it doesn't seem at the moment as if either party is particularly eager to take this on.
No, I think you're right, and Professor Hacker points out that this business of income insecurity within the same family doesn't really fit the rubrics of either party. The Democrats talk about poverty and inequality. The Republicans say, "Hey, risk is great," and so this problem almost goes unidentified. I do hear it, though, coming back. I mean, today Senator Edwards at a rally pointed out that there are now annually more bankruptcies for American families than divorces. Now, that's a very significant change. Not that one wants more divorces, but it spoke volumes to this condition that Elizabeth described of anxiety and of being one paycheck, two paychecks away from trouble. But you know, Jacob, you have an idea here about extending social insurance downward and outward to deal with this. Can you just help us with that for a minute?
Yeah, exactly right. I think it's really important that people understand, because we so often identify social insurance, if we even know the term at all, with Social Security, with programs for the aged. It's important to understand that there's no reason in principle that we couldn't extend this idea in those two directions. By downward, I mean we should extend the idea and the institutions of social insurance, the ones that apply, to working age people. And outward, I think that we have to have a more flexible system protecting people against catastrophic costs or episodes in their lives that impair their income, regardless of whether they fit into some small category that's covered by a current program. We've sort of divided up the world into health programs, into unemployment programs, into programs that deal with retirement. But we haven't thought about the fact that for many families, the real problem is a combination of these, and it's the unexpected expenses that can come sort of out of the blue. And I think that the ideal that I have is a sort of universal insurance program that would cover a wide range of risks.
All right. I want to explore that further in just a moment, Jacob. But I also, speaking of real-life stories, want to go to Buffalo, New York now. We want to hear from Robert. Sounds as if it's something that you've experienced, Robert.
Oh, yes. I was about to read a book, but I heard the commercial after the Jim Lehrer report that you were coming on. I said, oh, I got to listen to this. I thank your guests, and I agree with virtually everything they say. In my situation, I'm a nurse practitioner, And I had a history of working in health manpower shortage areas, establishing clinics. At age 40, I said I got to try it on my own, establish a health center, my own private practice for the working poor. I was very anxious about all the things that you people are talking about. And the reason I made the decision at age 40, that if it failed at 45, I knew I'd only have 20 years or so left to work, and I'd have to save everything I could so I'd have some kind of retirement. Well, the worst scenario did happen to me, a combination of an extremely rare disease that is an occupational hazard cut me down. And I'm glad there is a safety net, but it was really, really rough getting to it. And I want to make one comment on the safety net. Medicaid is coming under tremendous fire. Fortunately, with my knowledge of the healthcare system, and you treat patients for 26, 27 years, you see all these catastrophes that do happen, you know, close and up front. Anyway, I paid for the best plan Blue Cross and Blue Shield has for 8 months ahead of time. Had I to rely on Medicaid, I'd either be dead, that would be the fortunate outcome, or I'd be paralyzed and institutionalized. So I have a lot more to say, but I don't want to monopolize it. If you have any questions, I'll answer them.
All right. Did you have a specific question you wanted to pose, Robert, or wanted to share your story?
I didn't know how many people you would run across in the conversation that went a step or two beyond the anxiety and had to experience.
Exactly, yes.
4.5 years of sheer hell, to be honest with you.
Well, thanks so much for calling. Sorry it has been such a tough time for you. Yeah, what do you say to people like Robert Jacob? You know, would your plan deal with them? And is it pie in the sky? Is it even possible?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing I would just want to say is that Robert's experience isn't atypical. There's a lot of scholarship that suggests that people just vastly understate the risks of events like those that hit Robert. They happen very infrequently at any particular point in time, but over the life course, things like this happen to people. And a good example of this is long-term care. People accurately say that only about 5% of the population is elderly populations in a nursing home, but what they forget is that over the period that you're aged, you have about a 50% chance of ending up in a nursing home. The point is that we tend to underestimate significantly the chance that these things will happen. To Robert, I think that the answer would have to be that at the current time that he has to take advantage of the programs that exist. But what I would really like is to have a system in which people don't have to go into poverty. And I'd like to explain that some more.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we will continue on that point. We're discussing economic risk and economic insecurity that Americans live with more and more every day. So do you feel more economically insecure, and how do you define it? Who do you blame, government, corporations, or is risk a good thing? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the new American economic insecurity, families living without a safety net to catch them in times of crisis. Are you feeling economically insecure? Should the government be trying to protect Americans from risk? Do you feel more financially insecure than your parents? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Jacob Hacker, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Yale University and author of The Divided Welfare State, The Battle Over Public and Private Social Benefits in the United States, and with Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. And Jacob, I had to cut you off earlier, so now here's the chance. Tell us what to do about it. Is there a way that we can protect people from risk without discouraging appropriate risk-taking?
Well, I think that's absolutely the right question. And I think Jack Beatty really hit the nail on the head when he suggested that we don't expect businesses or entrepreneurs to take all the risks themselves. We have limited liability for corporations. We underwrite important types of research efforts that are highly risky. We protect, in other words, people against the worst consequences of risks precisely because we want them to take risks. So I think there's ample reason for us to act. And action could start modestly and move towards more serious measures. I mean, as a starting point, I think we just need to be a little bit more aware as citizens of the kinds of economic risks that are out there. We have a huge range of economic indicators, but not a single one, it's striking, really concerns this question of overtime economic risk. The economist Robert Shiller, for example, has come up with some innovative ideas to create markets for some of the kinds of things that really affect families' life income chances. For example, markets for long-term markets that would reflect long-term the risk of long-term earnings in certain careers, so that people could know what these risks are, or to see the risk of housing prices falling. But I think we need some kind of institutions that are out there for government institutions that are out there to really have a central role in publicizing and dealing with these risks, a sort of Department of Economic Security, if you will, like the Department of Homeland Security. And ultimately, I think we need, as I've said, some kind of universal insurance system. And that would really be something that policymakers could design. But I think the idea would be it would offer two kinds of protections. One, it would replace some of people's income when life events occurred that either caused them to lose their job or that caused them to not be able to work at the same number of hours, disability or unemployment, but also the kinds of things like sickness at home that aren't usually dealt with existing programs. The other side of it would be some protection against really catastrophic expenses. We have no catastrophic health insurance program. So just in putting in place something like that to protect people who don't have insurance or whose insurance phases out at a certain level would really go a long way. It's striking. Elizabeth Warren at Harvard has done some research on bankruptcy that 87% of bankruptcies are due to three basic causes: loss of a job, some family-related crisis, and family breakup. And in fact, about half are due to just those kinds of crises at home, like loss of a job or illness. That's just not counting family breakup.
Well, and doesn't this philosophically start with a basic premise which says, hey, folks, we're all in this together, and this could happen to any one of us at any time?
It's very important that people recognize that this isn't an us versus them issue. It's not an issue of rich versus poor. All of us face this risk. I was very struck when I was looking at this data that of people in the top half of the income distribution, about one in five fall into poverty over a 10-year period. So we know all about the rags-to-riches story, but we don't hear much about the riches-to-rags story. People go up the income ladder. That's social mobility, as Jack Beatty was suggesting. They go down the income ladder. And it may be the case that some of us are better prepared to deal with these risks, but all of us, I think, face them. And that's the premise of social insurance, that we should have some common pool of protection. We're all in this together. And it's a value that most Americans believe in. The programs that have this basic ideal are the most popular programs in the American system, because they don't take from average working people and give to poor people who are not working. They take from people who have experience, who are doing pretty well, and give to people who often through no fault of their own have experienced some catastrophic event. And I think it would really change the debate over social policy if we thought a little bit more about this question of how well protected we are over time against major risks to our income.
And Jack, how would you see that playing out on the campaign trail?
Well, I think the Democrats are talking about some of these things, and they're talking about them in different contexts, perhaps.
Yeah, I haven't heard it articulated exactly this way. Have you?
No. And one reason, of course, is that it's very expensive to talk about extending the welfare state. And it's controversial because the welfare state has been derogated and demonized. The term arose during World War II in Britain, and its opposite was the warfare state. Welfare was thought to be a good thing. But, of course, that's been torn down, so there needs to be a kind of rehabilitation. But when you start to look at what things would cost, it's not that much. For example, a few years ago, I calculated that to extend long-term care insurance for everyone, meaning that when you went into a nursing home, you didn't have to sell all your assets in order to qualify for Medicaid, which happens to people quickly in nursing homes because they cost $40,000, $50,000 a year. To preserve your family wealth against that catastrophe, it would cost the average taxpayer $125 a year. That's not much for this huge benefit. And I think if you start to look at pieces of this in terms of, well, what would it cost me as opposed to what catastrophe would it protect me against, a lot of this looks like a pretty good deal.
Yes, and Jacob, I was wondering how this would play in terms of the tax cut. I mean, if you took that $500 that each family or approximately got and put it into something like what you're suggesting, that would cover it, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to contrast this vision with one that would say that we just need to give people back the money that they're paying in taxes, because ultimately, the idea here is that there are some common risks and common responsibilities, and that government, to a certain level, will help citizens deal with that. The thing that I want to stress, though, is I actually think this is really quite consistent with what Americans believe. And I also want to stress that it's not as if we're not paying for these risks now. And it's not just in the heartbreak and anxiety that Americans are feeling that we're paying for it. We're paying for it right now through a horribly inefficient emergency room care system. We're paying for it now through a whole bevy of programs that often require that people commit fraud by hiding their assets or spend down all their money to receive benefits. I think it's important to understand that the system as it is now really makes people feel as if they have to sort of throw themselves on the mercy of charity to receive benefits. And the point here is that there are some things that we as a society believe that citizens should be protected against precisely because we want them to take risks, precisely because we want them to be productive members of society. Rapid change in our society and our economy is a good thing in many cases, but it's only economically beneficial, I think, and morally defensible if it's done in a way that protects people against the greatest downside risks. We need a common safety net so we can all swing on the trapeze.
I wanted to ask in the minute or so we have left in this segment whether there was one particular response to your New York Times piece outlining all of this that really sticks in your mind.
Yes, and there was a woman who wrote me, and I won't say her name, of course, whose child had become very ill, and who had been whose husband had lost his job and was able to take another job, but the job didn't have health insurance benefits. So she went back into the workforce. But when she got back into the workforce, she discovered that the health insurance that she had gone back into the workforce to seek wouldn't cover the pre-existing condition of her child. And it was really poignant to read the story about how she'd basically had her life fortune spent on her child's illness and was now on Medicaid.
Well, Jacob, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Jacob Hacker is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Yale University. And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In just a moment, and Jack, thank you as well
thank
for being
you.
With us. Appreciate
thank
it,
you,
as always. In just a moment, we'll hear from one Brooklynite about his hope for a sporting chance. This is On Point. The owners of basketball's New Jersey Nets have agreed to sell the team to New York City real estate developer Bruce Ratner, a move that could bring Brooklyn its first major sports franchise since 1957, when baseball's Dodgers left for Los Angeles. Ratner wants to move the Nets to a new arena that is the jewel of a proposed $2.5 billion office, residential, and shopping complex in Brooklyn. Former Newsday sports columnist Stan Isaac says nothing would make him happier than to see his native Brooklyn return to sports major leagues. But in this radio diary, he says it's a Brooklynite's nature to doubt that it will all work out.
Because I am from Brooklyn, I am skeptical of this stirring in the wind about the New Jersey Nets moving there. it's nice that this real estate guy, Bruce Ratner, is ready to put up $300 million or more to buy the team. It certainly is impressive that the eminent architect Frank Gehry has designed a stunning downtown complex to house Ratner's would-be Brooklyn Nets. It certainly would please every Brooklynite, past and present, to see the renovation of the Flatbush Avenue extension and Atlantic Avenue area that has been such an eyesore for years. Go, Ratner, go. But Ratner would need approval of three-quarters of the other 28 NBA owners to buy the team. And he would need at least a majority vote to move the team. And there is the question of getting the approval of the city and the state. And surely there will be some community groups in the area who will pop up with objections of their own. To use an old Brooklyn expression, oy vey. But still, I have this crazy vision. I see out of the mist two of the most celebrated Knicks fans who are Brooklynites, Woody Allen and Spike Lee. They are sitting near the court, not at Madison Square Garden, but at the Ratner Gehry Xanadu, rooting for the Brooklyn team. I hope that Ratner overcomes all the hurdles and brings the Nets to Brooklyn, because Brooklyn deserves a major league team. Sports owes Brooklyn. That goes back, of course, to the sellout of the borough by former Dodgers owner Walter O'Malley, who deserted the borough for the riches of the West. I have trouble even typing the name O'Malley. And when I do, I can't help think of a little folderole about the man who promised he wouldn't move the Dodgers because his roots were in Brooklyn. As the story has it, writers Pete Hamill and Jack Newfield were idling and came up with the idea of naming the three worst people in history. They settled on Hitler, Stalin, and O'Malley. Sometime afterward, I was interviewing author Doris Kearns Goodwin regarding her book about growing up in Rockville Center, Long Island, as a Dodger fan. I asked her if she knew the Hamill-Newfield story. She said she had, and added, "Do you know the kicker to the story?" I didn't. She said, "You are in a room with Hitler, Stalin, and O'Malley, and you have a gun with two bullets in it. What do you do?" Pause. "You shoot the two bullets at O'Malley." I've always felt that the worst thing that ever happened to Brooklyn, well, second to the Dodgers leaving, was it becoming part of New York City in 1897. It has lived in the shadow of Gotham ever since. So I am for anything that is good for Brooklyn. I went to Eastern District High School in Williamsburg, whose notable graduates were Mel Brooks Nee Kaminsky and author Henry Miller. Brooklyn also had Alan King, Mae West, Walt Whitman, Barbara Stanwyck, Susan Hayward, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Joseph Heller, even Moe and Curly Howard of the Three Stooges, and, of course, Sandy Koufax. We gave. It is long overdue that we were given back. If Ratner pulls it off, I think there ought to be a better name than the Brooklyn Nets. How about the Brooklyn Dodgers?
Brooklyn native Stan Isaacs is a former sports columnist for Newsday. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.